Next, we're going to be talking with Grace Conte from Portnoy, Messenger, and Pearl in our next segment after the news.
This is Bold Talk Business Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, the CEO of Bold Marketing Solutions, Donna Anselmo.
This is Donna Anselmo, back for the second half of Bold Talk Business Radio. Thanks for hanging in with us, and thanks for joining us if you just tuned in. We've got Pete Anselmo in the studio with us and Vince Young running the board today, and we're happy to be here because we've got a great guest for the second half here. We thank Wayne Price. Maybe you're listening in the car, so we had a great time with you today in the studio and want to get on to our discussion with Grace Conte. Grace Conte is with a company called Portnoy, Messenger, Pearl & Associates in New York, but it's a national firm that provides human resources and labor relations consulting services to a broad spectrum of clients in both the public and private sectors. They work with unions, non-unions, small local businesses, and multinational Fortune 500 companies. Now, why this is important is because PMP has HR professionals, human resource professionals, and in-house attorneys on staff that allow them to be very helpful and cost-effective so that you don't necessarily have to go out to a law firm to get this information. You can go right to Portnoy, Messenger, and Pearl. The focus of this company is to teach people through education so that they can avoid litigation. So, Grace Conte, thanks for being with us today to discuss some very important aspects of affirmative action plans and why they can help to reduce litigation for customers, so and for small businesses and large businesses alike. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Donna. Thank you for having me on and to speak on the important subject of job seeker versus applicant, which has traditionally been an Achilles heel for the federal contracting community.
Why is there a need to differentiate between who is a job seeker and who is an applicant if you are looking particularly to sign a government contract or if you're using federal workers? Why is this so important?
Well, federal contractors have a great deal of data analysis that they must do in order to prove that they do not discriminate in any of their personnel actions. Unlike our court system where you are innocent until proven guilty, during an audit, you are presumed non-compliant unless your data and records can prove that you're in compliance. And one of the analysis that is done is who is, for every hire, who is the pool that you looked at or, you know, check their applications and their resume? Did they meet the basic qualifications? And did you hire in a non-discriminatory fashion?
Grace, who is likely to go through an audit of their hiring processes?
Well, Donna, that's one of the best kept secrets as to how or why a certain contractor is selected. First of all, you have to have a contract of $50,000 or more and 50 employees or more in order to be required to have a formally written affirmative action plan. And then the Department of Labor, Office of Federal Contract Compliance, otherwise known as the OFCCP, since it's such a mouthful, randomly selects companies, federal contractors, for audit. And it is pretty, there is no really rhyme or reason that anyone has been able to figure out how they are selected. And once you're selected, you have 30 days from receipt of the letter to send in an enormous amount of data for every personnel action that you do, whether it be applicant versus who did you hire, promotions, terminations. So everything is analyzed.
Does this apply also to a staffing agency as opposed to the actual hiring company?
Yes, it does. If that staffing agency is providing applicants to a federal contractor or subcontractor. Up until now, staffing agency have really flown under the radar. But with the increase of executive orders and OFCCP regulations, they are looking deeper into where did these applicants come from. And the worst mistake a contractor can show on their data is They only had one applicant, and that's the person they hired, because it would appear as that is a discriminatory hire. You handpicked someone. You didn't give other people the opportunity to apply for that position.
I remember when I worked at Stony Brook University many years ago, that was one of the first, my first exposure to affirmative action hiring. And I was on search committees, and we had to go through a process of making sure that we had a big enough pool of applicants that we would be able to document that we did the search appropriately.
Yeah, I've been doing this for over 23 years, and certainly in the last 9 or 10 years since Director Patricia Hsu took over, it's been a very deep dive whenever we've had audits. And the issue of applicant flow and was there a non-discriminatory hire has really been her biggest area that she has been able to get very high settlements and fines. Is there that much discrimination? Most of the time where I've read about these cases, it's mostly has to do with lack of documentation, not being able to articulate why someone was not chosen, why someone was not interviewed. So this has been a really gray area for a long time. So in 2006, the OFCCP came out with four distinct criteria that makes a job seeker become an applicant. And why that's important is that once you've identified them as applicants, they must go on a data collection sheet called an applicant flow, and that's where the analysis is done.
So can you make a distinction right now for the difference between a job seeker and an applicant?
As I said, there in 2006, which is 10 years ago, and there's still a lot of confusion on this, there were four distinct criteria that were put out that for a job seeker that must meet in order for them to become an applicant. And I'll go through them very quickly. One is the individual submits an expression of interest in employment through the internet or related electronic data technologies they meet. That means they must apply for your open position. Another criteria is the contractor considers the individual for employment in that particular position. That means you're reviewing their credentials, their resumes, their application. The third criteria, or one of the four, is the individual's expression of interest indicates that the individual possesses the basic qualifications. Of course, there's nothing in the law that prevents you from hiring the best qualified. They have to have the basic qualifications that you need for your open position. And the fourth criteria is that individual or that job seeker at this point, at no point during the contractor's selection process prior to receiving a job offer, removes himself or herself, such as you call them and they say, no, just accepted another position. They have removed themselves at that point, even though they might have met all the other three. Therefore, they don't go on the applicant flow chart and they don't get analyzed. And on the applicant flow chart, of course, you have to collect gender, ethnicity, race, and lots of data. And that's what gets analyzed. And if you meet their new, you know, it's two standard deviation, plus or minus, a flag goes up, they flag you, and they want to really delve into why certain people were not interviewed or certain people were not hired.
So Grace Conte from Portnoy Messenger Pearl and Associates, Inc., can you tell us a little bit about where companies typically go wrong on this issue?
Absolutely. When we go in and do a mock audit, the thing that flags the applicant data for me is that it only shows those that were interviewed. I mean, if you're looking for job requirements, there's probably more than you might have 15 people that all have the basic qualification, but you only interviewed the top five. That's fine. What I don't want to see is that only those five are your applicants. Your applicant pool is much greater than just the people you interviewed. Certainly, one applicant, one hire is a big no-no because it can be perceived as discriminatory that you handpick that person without giving other people the opportunity to apply for that position. So those are two big no-nos.
What are the biggest areas of vulnerability, so to speak, in an applicant flow during an audit?
I think that very often there are either two large pools that basically anyone that applied for the job is considered an applicant, and that's also wrong because you can use a data management technique that controls the numbers. So there's a saying in the affirmative action community, big numbers are bad numbers, because the larger the pool, the higher the chances are that you will trigger to a plus or minus two standard deviation, that it can be perceived as if there's discrimination against females or one of the other protected races or ethnicities.
We have Pete Anselmo in the studio with us as well.
Yeah, Grace, I have a question on your use of the term standard deviation, two standard deviations. Can you clarify that aspect of this project?
Certainly. And I'm going to give you, because I am mathematically challenged, to have someone do a very simplistic example. And if I had a quarter and I flipped it five times and it came out heads each time, you know, you might say, that's an interesting coincidence. But if I flipped that coin 25 times and every time it came out heads again, you would probably say, hey, that's fixed. That cannot be happening by chance. And it's the same theory. If you're constantly hiring females over males, it will trigger that plus or minus two standard deviation. And basically, the OFCCP is saying, this is not occurring by chance. You are doing something to make this happen, to make it that only you're hiring Hispanics or only you're hiring Asians or whatever the case may be. This is not happening by chance. That's where that two standard deviation analysis comes in.
So that's really a function of the pool that you're drawing from. And, you know, it's sort of counterintuitive that you would not look for a large pool, because a large pool would actually give you an easier chance of a distribution that's more than several standard deviations. But you're saying that the too large a pool is not good either.
Now, we recommend really 25, as you know, anywhere from 10 to 25, depending on the skill. We see a lot of cases. I said Ms. Hsu has been very successful in getting very large settlements, and mostly in this area, in the applicant pool, because that's where a lot of hiring is done very quickly, and poor records are kept. So audits come down a year to 2 years later, and either your manager is no longer there who made the decision, and where you have less skilled positions, the differential between one applicant and another, or one job seeker and another, is very small. It's sometimes even harder to say this person had the best skills or the higher skills. So that's why you want to keep it small enough that allows you to not trigger that, but large enough that there's no perception, and most of this is perception, that there was a discriminatory reason why you only had three people or five people. Certainly 10 to 25 is the number I like to keep it in.
We're speaking with Grace Conte, who's Executive Vice President and Director of Affirmative Action Compliance for Portnoy Messenger Pearl & Associates, Inc., based in Syosset, New York. Grace, one of the things that I'm thinking about as I'm listening to what you're talking about is how a job is posted and a company is flooded with resumes. So how does that company distinguish between the fact that somebody sent in a resume, which makes them essentially a job seeker, and then in their mind, they may think they're applying for the position, and you're making a distinction between the job seeker and the applicant. So how is somebody really supposed to understand where they stand in a pool?
And this is, well, job seekers probably wouldn't know where they stand in the pool. It is up to the company to use what is known as a data management technique. So very often, and again, in the less skilled jobs, you're flooded. You might get 1,000 applicants. You certainly don't have the time or the energy to look at 1,000. So you establish a data management. again, using my magic 25, you might look at the most recently received 25 applications. Or if you have a larger pool, we recommend you go deeper. So every other one up until you hit the 25. Then you take that 25, you'll look at those, and perhaps not all of them will meet the four criteria. Maybe right. Some of them, you know, everybody wants to be an engineer, but it doesn't mean that they have the background or the skills. So you might get that down to maybe only 15 that have qualified, and you work with those 15. If in those 25 you don't find them, then you go another 25. So you have a very non-discriminatory, systematic way that you can prove this is how we got to that. Yes, you may not get to see all thousands, but most companies wouldn't have the time or the staff to go through that many.
So, Grace, I know that you are an affirmative action specialist, and I want our listeners to know that companies come to you for consulting so that they make sure that they don't end up getting fined, losing a lawsuit, or being sued to begin with because they haven't followed proper procedures. So you have clients from a variety of industries, including aerospace, which of course is particularly interesting here on the Space Coast of Florida, aviation, communications, manufacturing, and other service industries that you work with to help them go through their process of building an affirmative action plan. Can you talk a little bit about the best practices for documenting and supporting the reasons that people accept or reject candidates?
I think best practices right now, because there has been an influx of OFCCP regulations, a body of which came down March 24, 2014. And also President Obama has recently signed about four or five executive orders that pertain exclusively to the federal contracting community. I have to say that I think training is probably one of the best things that a company can do for their managers and supervisors, because HR knows the rules and regulations. What they often cannot do is get compliance from their managers and supervisors to follow the policies and procedures that have been implemented. And I've been actually doing a lot of training in California and Florida for our clients. And I almost see the light bulb go on the managers that they say, oh, wow, now we understand why we're asked to keep certain documentation. We thought HR was just telling us to do it because they have nothing better to do, which is very often the feeling that HR says, yeah, I've told them that already.
Yeah, we're just here to give more red tape.
Exactly.
An interesting point. I was just curious as to what the general or overall reaction is from businesses that have to comply with this. It strikes me that a lot of businesses are really up to here with all the rules and regulations, that it's creating an incredible burden on businesses. Do you find that negative reaction often?
Absolutely. I actually have recently had a small business with just about 60 people who went through an audit 2 years ago and actually said to me, I don't know if my contract is worth all the, they've had to hire staff to keep track of all this data. Mm-hmm. You hit it on the head. It's a huge burden, and it's not going to decrease because there's two executive orders on the horizon. And if they get passed, it's going to just increase the amount of, I hate to say that, but bureaucratic paperwork that's involved with showing compliance. Again, you have to keep in mind that you are assumed non-compliant unless you can prove by your record keeping that you are, in fact, in compliance.
Yeah, that seems to be a pretty significant burden, because I think most people look to do the right thing. They're not looking to hire in a negative fashion, but that the fact that you have to document each step that you take becomes the burden.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we work with many applicant tracking systems, which the larger companies often have, but the smaller companies have really either can't afford to buy one or have had to buy one with the new regulations, because there's so much data now that you must ask a job seeker, you know, their gender, their ethnicity, their race, Are they a protected veteran? Are they an individual with disability? And all of this data has to be gathered and then shown on the analysis sheets. And you certainly need to keep that super confidential. And so it's almost become, there's certain things that all contractors almost have to buy or invest in these days.
Grace Connie, we have a minute and a half left. Can you talk a little bit quickly about the importance of contractors' goals and discussing your goals with the hiring team?
Oh, thank you, Donna, for reminding me of that. Yes, you know, every year you have goals, and that's an analysis that is done between who is currently in your workforce versus what the census data has established in the reasonable recruiting area and where you are perceived as underutilized for females or minority per job group. You have to set goals. And managers should be aware of what those goals are, whether they are, the goal is to increase females or minorities in a certain job group. It's very important because as they review resumes, if the resumes are so similar and your goal is for females and you do have a lot of females applying, you better have really, really good documentation.
Yes, let's leave it there because I want you to be able to tell people how to get in touch with you, Grace Conte.
Thank you. Grace Conte at 800-921-2195 or go to our website, www.pmphr.com.
And you can visit the online archive at 1060WMEL.com for more information or to hear a rebroadcast of this segment today. Thank you so much, Grace Conte and Portnoy Messenger Pearl & Associates for being with us today.
Thank you, Donna.
See you next time.